The suites look like upper-end hotel rooms, spacious, bright, and well-appointed, with wood-grain furniture, floral wallpaper, curtains, a whirlpool bath, and just for Dad, a comfy couch that folded out into a bed. Instead of standard-issue hospital food, guests were offered a choice of gourmet dinners. When Jenny's big day came and we arrived at the hospital, overnight bag in hand, we were told there was a little problem. "It must be a good day for having babies," the receptionist said cheerfully. "All the birthing suites are already taken." "Now wait a second," I complained. "We made our reservation weeks ago." "I'm sorry," the woman said with a noticeable lack of sympathy. "We don't exactly have a lot of control over when mothers go into labor." She made a valid point. It wasn't like she could hurry someone along. She directed us to another floor, where we would be issued a standard hospital room. But when we arrived in the maternity ward, the nurse at the counter had more bad news. "Would you believe every last room is filled?" "What do you suggest, the parking lot?" The nurse smiled calmly at me. "Don't you worry, we'll find a spot for you." After a flurry of phone calls, she sent us down a long hallway and through a set of double doors, where we found ourselves in a mirror image of the maternity ward we had just left, except for one obvious difference. "Welcome to the indigent ward," Dr. Sherman said brightly when he breezed in a few minutes later. "Don't be fooled by the bare-bones rooms." They were outfitted with some of the most sophisticated medical equipment in the hospital, and the nurses were some of the best trained. Because poor women often lacked access to prenatal care, theirs were some of the highest-risk pregnancies. "We were in good hands," he assured us as he broke Jenny's water. Then, as quickly as he had appeared, he was gone. Indeed, as the morning progressed and Jenny fought her way through ferocious contractions, we discovered we were in very good hands. The nurses were seasoned professionals who exuded confidence and warmth, attentively hovering over her, checking the baby's heartbeat and coaching Jenny along. I stood helplessly by, trying my best to be supportive. I began slipping out of the room to join the other men waiting in the hallway. Each of us leaned against the wall beside our respective doors as our wives screamed and moaned away. They couldn't speak English and I couldn't speak Spanish, but that didn't matter. We were in this together. Or almost together. I learned that day that in America, pain relief is a luxury, not a necessity. For those who could afford it, or whose insurance covered it as ours did, the hospital provided epidurals. The Mexican women nearby were not so lucky. They were left to tough it out the old-fashioned way, and their shrieks continued to punctuate the air. As night fell, I stepped out into the hall, bearing a tiny swaddled football. I lifted my newborn son above my head for my new friends to see and called out, "Es el niño!" The other dads flashed big smiles and held up their thumbs in the international sign of approval. Unlike our heated struggle to name our dog, we would easily and almost instantly settle on a name for our firstborn son. He would be named Patrick, for the first of my line of Grogans to arrive in the United States from County Limerick, Ireland. A nurse came into our cubicle and told us a birthing suite was now available. It seemed rather beside the point to change rooms now, but she helped Jenny into a wheelchair, placed our son in her arms, and whisked us away. The gourmet dinner wasn't all it was cracked up to be. During the weeks leading up to her due date, Jenny and I had had long strategy talks about how best to acclimate Marley to the new arrival who would instantly knock him off his, until now, undisputed perch as most favored dependent. We had heard stories of dogs becoming terribly jealous of infants and acting out in unacceptable ways. In the 36 hours that Jenny remained hospitalized recuperating after birth, I made frequent trips home to visit Marley, armed with receiving blankets and anything else that carried the baby's scent. On one of my visits, I even brought home a tiny, used, disposable diaper, which Marley sniffed with such vigor I feared he might suck it up his nostril. When I finally brought mother and child home, Marley was oblivious. Jenny placed baby Patrick, asleep in his car carrier, in the middle of our bed, and then joined me in greeting Marley. Marley followed Jenny into the bedroom, jamming his nose deep into her overnight bag as she unpacked. He clearly had no idea there was a living thing sitting on our bed. Then Patrick stirred and let out a small, bird-like chirp. Marley's ears pulled up and he froze. Where did that come from? Patrick chirped again, and Marley lifted one paw in the air, pointing like a bird dog. My God! He was pointing at our baby boy like a hunting dog would point at prey. Then he lunged. It was not a ferocious, kill-the-enemy lunge. There were no bared teeth or growls. But it wasn't a welcome-to-the-neighborhood-little-buddy lunge, either. His chest hit the mattress with such force that the entire bed jolted across the floor. Patrick was wide awake now, eyes wide. Marley recoiled and lunged again, this time bringing his mouth within inches of our newborn's toes. Jenny dove for the baby, and I dove for the dog, pulling him back by the collar with both hands. Marley was beside himself, straining to get at this new creature that somehow had snuck into our inner sanctum. Jenny unbuckled Patrick from his car seat. I pinned Marley between my legs and held him tightly by the collar with both fists. Marley meant no harm. He was panting with that dopey grin of his eyes were bright, and his tail was wagging. As I held tight, Jenny gradually came closer, allowing Marley to sniff first the baby's toes, then his feet and calves and thighs. When Marley reached the diaper, he seemed to enter an altered state of consciousness, a sort of Pampers-induced trance. He had reached the Holy Land. The dog looked positively euphoric. One false move, Marley, and you're toast, Jenny warned. But we soon learned our problem was not keeping Marley from hurting our precious baby boy. Our problem was keeping him out of the diaper pail. As the days turned into weeks and the weeks into months, Marley came to accept Patrick as his new best friend. One night, early on, as I was turning off the lights to go to bed, I couldn't find Marley anywhere. Finally, I thought to look in the nursery, and there he was, stretched out on the floor beside Patrick's crib, the two of them snoring away in stereophonic fraternal bliss. Marley, our wild, crashing bronco, seemed to understand that this was a fragile, defenseless little human, and he moved gingerly when he was near him, licking his face and ears delicately. As Patrick began crawling, Marley would lie quietly on the floor and let the baby scale him like a mountain, tugging on his ears, poking his eyes, and pulling out little fistfuls of fur. None of it fazed him. Marley just sat like a statue. He was a gentle giant around Patrick, and he accepted his second fiddle status with bonhomie and good-natured resignation. Jenny and I settled into a routine. At nighttime, she would get up with Patrick every few hours to nurse him, and I would take the 6 a.m. feeding so she could sleep in. Half asleep, I would pluck him from his crib, change his diaper, and make a bottle of formula for him. Then the payoff. I would sit on the back porch with his tiny warm body nestled against my stomach as he sucked on the bottle. Sometimes I would let my face rest against the top of his head and doze off as he ate lustily. Sometimes I would listen to National Public Radio and watch the dawn sky turn from purple to pink to blue. When he was fed and I had gotten a good burp out of him, I would get us both dressed, whistle for Marley, and take a morning walk along the water. Parenthood, we found, suited us well. We settled into its rhythms, celebrated its simple joys, and grinned our way through its frustrations, knowing even the bad days, soon enough, would be cherished memories. We had everything we could ask for. We had our precious baby. We had our numbskull dog. We had our little house by the water. Of course, we also had each other. That November, my newspaper promoted me to columnist, a coveted position that gave me my own space on the section front 3 times a week to spout off about whatever I wanted. Life was good. When Patrick was 9 months old, Jenny wondered aloud when we might want to start thinking about having another baby. "Oh, gee, I don't know," I said. We always knew we wanted more than one, but I hadn't really thought about a time frame. Repeating everything we had just gone through seemed like something best not rushed into. "I guess we could just go back off birth control and see what happens." Ah, the old que sera sera school of family planning. So that is what we did. We figured if we conceived any time in the next year, the timing would be about right. Jenny did the math. Let's say 6 months to get pregnant and then 9 more months to deliver. That would put 2 full years between them. It sounded good to me. 2 years was next to an eternity. A week later, Jenny was knocked up. Chapter 13. A Scream in the Night. When Patrick was not quite a year old, murder came again to our block. Like Mrs. Niedermeyer, the victim was an elderly woman who lived alone. Hers was the first house as you turned onto Churchill Road off Dixie Highway, directly behind the all-night open-air laundromat, and I only knew her to wave to as I passed. The attacker was a stranger who snuck into her house while she was in the backyard hanging her laundry on a Saturday afternoon. When she returned, he bound her wrist with telephone cord and shoved her beneath a mattress as he ransacked the house for money. He fled with his plunder as my frail neighbor slowly suffocated beneath the weight of the mattress. Police quickly arrested a drifter who had been seen hanging around the coin laundry. When they emptied his pockets, they found his total haul had been $16 and change, the price of a human life. The crime swirling around us made us grateful for Marley's bigger-than-life presence in our house. When strangers came to our door, we no longer locked Marley away before answering. We stopped assuring them how harmless he was. We had a baby now, and another on the way. Jenny and I often speculated about just what, if anything, Marley would do if someone ever tried to hurt the baby or us. I tended to think he would merely grow frantic. Jenny placed more faith in him. She was convinced his special loyalty to us, especially to his new Cheerios pusher Patrick, would translate in a crisis to a fierce primal protectiveness that would rise up from deep within him. Then one night, he settled the dispute once and for all. It was October, and the weather still had not turned. The night was sweltering. I was just drifting off when I heard it, a shrill, sustained, piercing noise. I was instantly wide awake, and Marley was too. He stood frozen beside the bed in the dark, ears cocked. It came again, penetrating the sealed windows, rising above the hum of the air conditioner. A woman's scream, loud and unmistakable. There was desperation in it, real terror. And it was dawning on me that someone was in terrible trouble. "Come on, boy." I slipped out of bed. "Don't go out there." I hadn't realized Jenny was awake, too. "Call the police. I'll be careful." Holding Marley by the end of his choker chain, I stepped out onto the front porch in my boxer shorts, just in time to glimpse a figure sprinting down the street toward the water. The scream came again from the opposite direction. Outside, without the walls and glass to buffet it, the woman's voice filled the night air with an amazing, piercing velocity, the likes of which I had heard only in horror movies. Other porch lights were flicking on. The two young men who shared a rental house across the street from me burst outside wearing nothing but cutoffs and ran toward the screams. I followed, Marley tight by my side. I saw them run up on a lawn a few houses away and then, seconds later, come dashing back toward me. "Go to the girl!" one of them shouted, pointing. "She's been stabbed!" "We're going after him!" the other one yelled, and they sprinted off barefoot down the street in the direction the figure had fled. My neighbor Barry, a fearless single woman, jumped into her car and joined the chase. I let go of Marley's collar and ran toward the scream. 3 doors down, I found my 17-year-old neighbor standing alone in her driveway, bent over, sobbing in jagged, raspy gasps. She clasped her ribs, and beneath her hands I could see a circle of blood spreading across her blouse. She was a thin, pretty girl with sand-colored hair that fell over her shoulders. She lived in the house with her divorced mother, a pleasant woman who worked as a night nurse. I had chatted a few times with the mother, but I only knew her daughter to wave to. I didn't even know her name. "He said not to scream or he'd stab me," she said, sobbing. Her words gushed out in heaving, hyperventilated gulps. "But I screamed, and he stabbed me." As if I might not believe her, she lifted her shirt to show me the puckered wound that had punctured her ribcage. "I was sitting in my car with the radio on. He just came out of nowhere." I put my hand on her arm to calm her, and as I did, I saw her knees buckling. She collapsed into my arms, her legs folding fawn-like beneath her. I eased her down to the pavement and sat cradling her. Her words came softer, calmer now, and she fought to keep her eyes open. "He told me not to scream," she kept saying. "You did the right thing," I said. "You scared him away." It occurred to me that she was going into shock, and I had not the first idea what to do about it. "Come on, ambulance, where are you?" I comforted her in the only way I knew how, as I would comfort my own child, stroking her hair, holding my palm against her cheek, wiping her tears away. As she grew weaker, I kept telling her to hang on. Help was on the way. "You're going to be okay." I wasn't sure I believed it. Her skin was ashen. We sat alone on the pavement like that for what seemed hours, but was in actuality, the police report later showed, about 3 minutes. Only gradually did I think to check on what had become of Marley. When I looked up, there he stood, 10 feet from us, facing the street, in a determined, bull-like crouch I had never seen before. It was a fighter's stance. His muscles bulged at the neck, his jaw was clenched, the fur between his shoulder blades bristled. He was intensely focused on the street and appeared poised to lunge. I realized in that instant that Jenny had been right. If the armed assailant returned, he would have to get past my dog first. At that moment, I absolutely knew, without doubt, that Marley would fight him to the death before he would let him at us. I was emotional anyway as I held this young girl, wondering if she was dying in my arms. The sight of Marley so uncharacteristically guarding us like that, so majestically fierce, brought tears to my eyes. Man's best friend? Damn straight he was. "I've got you," I told the girl, but what I meant to say, what I should have said, was that we had her, Marley and me. "The police are coming. Hold on. Please. Just hold on." Before she closed her eyes, she whispered, "My name is Lisa. I'm John." It seemed ridiculous introducing ourselves in these circumstances as though we were at a neighborhood potluck. I almost laughed. Instead, I tucked a strand of her hair behind her ear and said, "You're safe now, Lisa." Like an archangel sent from heaven, a police officer came charging up the sidewalk. I whistled to Marley and called, "It's okay, boy. He's okay." And it was as if, with that whistle, I had broken some kind of trance. My goofy, good-natured pal was back. Soon an ambulance crew arrived with a stretcher and wads of sterile gauze. I stepped out of the way, told the police what I could, and walked home, Marley loping ahead of me. Jenny met me at the door, and together we stood in the front window watching the drama unfold on the street. You would have been proud of Marley. He felt the danger, and he was like a completely different dog. I told you so, and she had. It said something about South Florida's numbness to crime that the stabbing of a teenage girl as she sat in her car in front of her home would merit just 6 sentences in the morning newspaper. The story made no mention of me or Marley or the guys across the street who set out half-naked after the assailant. It didn't mention Barry, who gave chase in her car, or all the neighbors up and down the block who turned on porch lights and dialed 911. The knife had punctured Lisa's lung, and she spent 5 days in the hospital and several weeks recuperating at home. Her mother kept the neighbors apprised of her recovery, but the girl remained inside and out of sight. I worried about the emotional wounds the attack might leave. Would she ever again be comfortable leaving the safety of her home? Our lives had come together for just 3 minutes, but I felt invested in her as a brother might be in a kid's sister. Then as I washed the cars in the driveway on a Saturday, Marley chained up beside me, I looked up and there she stood. Prettier than I had remembered, tan, strong, athletic-looking, whole again. She smiled. Remember me? Let's see. Weren't you the one in front of me at the Tom Petty concert who wouldn't sit down? She laughed. So how are you doing, Lisa? I'm good, just about back to normal. You look great, a little better than the last time I saw you. Yeah, well, what a night. What a night, I repeated. That was all we said about it. She told me about the hospital, the doctors, the detectives who interviewed her, the endless fruit baskets, the boredom of sitting at home as she healed. But she steered clear of the attack, and so did I. Some things were best left behind. Lisa stayed a long time that afternoon, following me around the yard as I did chores, playing with Marley, making small talk. I sensed there was something she wanted to say but could not bring herself to. She was 17. I didn't expect her to find the words. Our lives had collided without plan or warning. In a heartbeat, there we were, intimately locked together in crisis, a dad in boxer shorts and a teenage girl in a blood-soaked blouse, clinging to each other and to hope. There was a closeness there now. How could there not be? There was also awkwardness, a slight embarrassment, for in that moment we had caught each other with our guards down. We had shared something that night on the pavement, one of those brief, fleeting moments of clarity that define all the others in a life, that neither of us would soon forget. By the time she left, I had a good feeling about this girl. She was strong, she would move forward, and indeed, I found out years later, when I learned she had built a career for herself as a television broadcaster, that she had. Chapter 14, An Early Arrival. John? Through the fog of sleep, I gradually registered my name being called. It was Jenny. She was shaking me. John, I think the baby might be coming. I propped myself up on an elbow and rubbed my eyes. Jenny was lying on her side, knees pulled to her chest. The baby what? I'm having bad cramps, she said. I've been lying here timing them. We need to call Dr. Sherman. I was wide awake now. Jenny was 21 weeks into the pregnancy, barely halfway through the 40-week gestation period. Among her motherhood books was a collection of high-definition in vitro photographs showing a fetus at each week of development. At 21 weeks, a fetus can fit in the palm of a hand. It weighs less than a pound. Its eyes are fused shut, its fingers like fragile little twigs, its lungs not yet developed enough to distill oxygen from air. At 21 weeks, a baby is barely viable. The chance of surviving outside the womb is small, and the chance of surviving without serious long-term health problems, smaller yet. It's probably nothing, I said, but I could feel my heart pounding as I speed-dialed the OBGYN answering service. 2 minutes later, Dr. Sherman called back, sounding groggy himself. It might just be gas, but we better have a look. He told me to get Jenny to the hospital immediately. Sorry, Mar, I told him as I led him out to the garage, grave disappointment on his face. You've got to hold down the fort. I scooped Patrick out of his crib, buckled him into his car seat without waking him, and into the night we went. At St. Mary's neonatal intensive care unit, the nurses quickly went to work. They got Jenny into a hospital gown and hooked her to a monitor that measured contractions and the baby's heartbeat. Sure enough, Jenny was having a contraction every 6 minutes. "Your baby wants to come out," one of the nurses said. "We're going to do everything we can to make sure he doesn't just yet." Dr. Sherman ordered an intravenous saline drip and an injection of the labor inhibitor Brethine. The contractions leveled out, but less than 2 hours later, they were back again. For the next 12 days, Jenny remained hospitalized. Poor Marley's status dropped precipitously from second fiddle to not even in the orchestra. Even as I ignored him, he faithfully followed me as I careened through the house with Patrick in one arm, vacuuming or toting laundry or fixing a meal with the other. One night, after I finally got Patrick to sleep, I fell back on the couch exhausted. Marley pranced over and dropped his rope tug toy in my lap and looked up at me with those giant brown eyes of his. "Sorry, pal, not tonight." He crinkled his brow and cocked his head. His mistress was mysteriously absent, his master no fun, and nothing the same. He let out a little whine, and I could see he was trying to figure it out. Life wasn't completely bleak for Marley. On the bright side, I had quickly reverted to my pre-marriage, read slovenly, lifestyle. I suspended the Married Couple Domesticity Act and proclaimed the once-banished bachelor rules to be the law of the land. While Jenny was in the hospital, shirts would be worn twice, even three times, barring obvious mustard stains, between washes. Milk could be drunk directly from the carton, and toilet seats would remain in the upright position unless being sat on. Much to Marley's delight, I instituted a 24/7 open-door policy for the bathroom. From there, it only made sense to let him start drinking from the bathtub tap. Now that the seat-up policy was firmly in place, I needed to offer Marley a viable alternative to that attractive porcelain pool. I got into the habit of turning the bathtub faucet on at a trickle while I was in the bathroom so Marley could lap up some cool fresh water. The dog could not have been more thrilled had I built him an exact replica of Splash Mountain. He would twist his head up under the faucet and lap away, tail banging the sink behind him. I soon realized I had created a bathtub monster. Pretty soon, Marley began going into the bathroom alone without me, and standing there, staring forlornly at the faucet, licking at it for any lingering drop, flicking the drain knob with his nose until I couldn't stand it any longer and would come in and turn it on for him. The next step on our descent into barbarity came when I was showering. I'd be lathering up, and without warning, his big tawny head would pop in, and he'd begin lapping at the shower spray. "Just don't tell Mom." I tried to fool Jenny into thinking I had everything effortlessly under control. "Oh, we're totally fine." Turning to Patrick, "Aren't we, partner?" To which he would give his standard reply, "Da, da," and then pointing at the ceiling fan, "Fan." She knew better. One day when I arrived with Patrick for our daily visit, she stared at us in disbelief. "What in God's name did you do to him?" "What do you mean? He's great. You're great, aren't you?" "Da, da, fan." "His outfit. How on earth?" Only then did I see. Something was amiss with Patrick's onesie. His chubby thighs were squeezed into the armholes, which were so tight they must have been cutting off his circulation. The collared neck hung between his legs like an udder. Up top, Patrick's head stuck out through the unsnapped crotch, and his arms were lost somewhere in the billowing pant legs. It was quite a look. "You goof! You've got it on him upside down!" "That's your opinion," I said. But the game was up. Jenny began working the phone from her hospital bed, and a couple of days later, my sweet dear Aunt Anita, a retired nurse who had come to America from Ireland as a teenager and now lived across the state from us, magically appeared, suitcase in hand, and cheerfully went about restoring order. The bachelor rules were history. When her doctors finally let Jenny come home, it was with the strictest of orders. If she wanted to deliver a healthy baby, she was to remain in bed as still as possible. The only time she was allowed on her feet was to go to the bathroom. Complete bed rest, no cheating, for the next 12 weeks. A hospital technician came to our home and attached a small battery-powered pump to Jenny's leg that delivered a continuous trickle of labor-inhibiting drugs into her bloodstream. Jenny was trying to keep her spirits up, but the boredom, the tedium, the hourly uncertainty about the health of her unborn child were conspiring to drag her down. Worst of all, she was a mother with a 15-month-old son whom she was not allowed to lift, feed, or scoop up and kiss. I would drop him on top of her on the bed, where he would pull her hair and stick his fingers into her mouth. He'd point to the whirling paddles above the bed and say, "Mama, fan." It made her smile, but it wasn't the same. She was slowly going stir-crazy. Her constant companion through it all, of course, was Marley. He set up camp on the floor beside her and held vigil, day and night. I tried to be encouraging, saying things like, "A year from now, we're going to look back on this and laugh." But I could tell part of her was slipping from me. Some days her eyes were very far away. When Jenny had a full month of bed rest still to go, Aunt Anita packed her suitcase and kissed us goodbye. She had stayed as long as she could, in fact, extending her visit several times. Once again, we were on our own. I did my best to keep the ship afloat, but the grass went uncut, the laundry unwashed, and the screen on the back porch remained unrepaired after Marley crashed through it, cartoon style, in pursuit of a squirrel. For weeks, the shredded screen door flapped in the breeze, becoming a de facto doggy door that allowed Marley to come and go as he pleased between the backyard and house during the long hours home alone with the bedridden Jenny. I could see dismay in Jenny's eyes. It took all of her self-control not to jump out of bed and whip her home back into shape. Then one day, as we approached Jenny's 35th week of pregnancy, the hospital technician arrived at her door and said, "Congratulations, girl. You've made it. You're free again." She unhooked the medicine pump, packed up the fetal monitor, and went over the doctor's written orders. Jenny was free to return to her regular lifestyle. The baby was fully viable now. "Have fun," she said. "You deserve it." Jenny tossed Patrick over her head, romped with Marley in the backyard, tore into the housework. That night we celebrated by going out for Indian food and catching a show at a local comedy club. The next day the three of us continued the festivities by having lunch at a Greek restaurant. Before the gyros ever made it to our table, however, Jenny was in full-blown labor. The cramps had begun the night before as she ate curried lamb, but she wasn't going to let a few contractions interrupt her hard-earned night on the town. By the time we got to the hospital and checked into a room, Jenny was dilated to 7 centimeters. Less than an hour later, I held our new son in my arms. "You did it," Dr. Sherman declared. "He's perfect." Connor Richard Grogan, 5 pounds and 13 ounces, was born October 10, 1993. I was so happy I barely gave a second thought to the cruel irony that for this pregnancy we had raided one of the luxury suites but had hardly a moment to enjoy it. If the delivery had been any quicker, Jenny would have given birth in the parking lot of the Texaco station. I hadn't even had time to stretch out on the dad couch. Considering what we had been through to bring him safely into this world, we thought the birth of our son was big news, but not so big that the local news media would turn out for it. Below our window, though, a crush of television news trucks gathered in the parking lot, their satellite dishes poking into the sky. I could see reporters with microphones doing their stand-ups in front of the cameras. "Hey, honey," I said, "the paparazzi have turned out for you." A nurse who was in the room attending to the baby said, "Can you believe it? Donald Trump is right down the hall. The real estate tycoon had caused quite a stir when he moved to Palm Beach several years earlier. I flicked on the TV and learned that the Donald and girlfriend Marla Maples were the proud parents of a girl appropriately named Tiffany, who was born not long after Jenny delivered Connor. "We'll have to invite them over for a play date," Jenny said. We watched from the window as the television crews swarmed in to catch the Trumps leaving the hospital with their new baby to return to their estate. Marla smiled demurely as she held her newborn for the cameras to capture. Donald waved and gave a jaunty wink. "I feel great," he told the cameras. Then they were off in a chauffeured limousine. The next morning, when our turn came to leave for home, a pleasant retiree who volunteered at the hospital guided Jenny and baby Connor through the lobby in a wheelchair and out the automatic doors into the sunshine. There were no camera crews, no satellite trucks, no sound bites, no live reports. It was just us and our senior volunteer. Not that anyone was asking, but I felt great too. Before buckling my newborn son into his car seat, I lifted him high above my head for the whole world to see, had anyone been looking, and said, "Connor Grogan, you are every bit as special as Tiffany Trump, and don't you ever forget it." Chapter 15, A Postpartum Ultimatum. These should have been the happiest days of our lives, and in many ways they were. We had two sons now, a toddler and a newborn, just 17 months apart. The joy they brought us was profound. Yet the darkness that had descended over Jenny while she was on forced bed rest persisted. Some weeks she was fine, cheerfully tackling the challenges of being responsible for two lives completely dependent on her for every need. Other weeks, without warning, she would turn glum and defeated, locked in a blue fog that sometimes would not lift for days. We were both exhausted and sleep-deprived. Patrick was still waking us at least once in the night, and Connor was up several more times, crying to be nursed or changed. Seldom did we get more than 2 hours of uninterrupted sleep at a stretch. Some nights we were like zombies, moving silently past each other with glazed eyes, Jenny to one baby and I to the other. We were up at midnight, and at 2, and at 3:30, and again at 5. Then the sun would rise, and with it, another day, bringing renewed hope and a bone-aching weariness as we began the cycle over again. From down the hall would come Patrick's sweet, cheery, wide-awake voice, "Mama, Dada, Than!" And as much as we tried to will it otherwise, we knew sleep, what there had been of it, was behind us for another day. I began making the coffee stronger and showing up at work with shirts wrinkled and baby spit up on my ties. One morning in my newsroom, I caught the young, attractive editorial assistant staring intently at me. Flattered, I smiled at her. Hey, I might be a dad twice over now, but the women still noticed me. Then she said, "Do you know you have a Barney sticker in your hair?" Complicating the sleep-deprived chaos that was our lives, our new baby had us terribly worried. Already underweight, Connor was unable to keep nourishment down. Jenny would offer him her breast, and he would oblige her, suckling hungrily. Then, in one quick heave, he would throw it all up. Over and over, the routine repeated itself, each time Jenny becoming more frantic. The doctors diagnosed reflux and referred us to a specialist. For 4 long months, we were consumed with worry over him. Jenny was a basket case of fear and stress and frustration, all exacerbated by lack of sleep, as she nursed him nearly nonstop and then watched helpless as he tossed her milk back at her. Her fuse was as short as I had seen it, and the smallest infractions, a cupboard door left open, crumbs on the counter, would set her off. The good news was Jenny never once took out her anxiety on either baby. In fact, she nurtured both of them with almost obsessive care and patience. She poured every ounce of herself into them. The bad news was that she directed her frustration and anger at me, and even more at Marley. She had lost all patience with him. He was squarely in her crosshairs and could do no right. Each transgression, and there continued to be many, pushed Jenny a little closer to the edge. Oblivious, Marley stayed the course with his antics and misdeeds in boundless ebullience. I bought a flowering shrub and planted it in the garden to commemorate Connor's birth. Marley pulled it out by the roots the same day and chewed it into mulch. I finally got around to replacing the ripped porch screen, and Marley, by now quite accustomed to his self-made doggy door, promptly dove through it again. He escaped one day, and when he finally returned, he had a pair of women's panties in his teeth. I didn't want to know. I started covering for him. When he crashed through our small home, the bowl in our china closet, I followed behind him, straightening throw rugs, righting coffee tables, and wiping up the spittle he flung on the walls. Before Jenny discovered them, I would race to vacuum up the wood chips in the garage where he had gouged the door once again. It was into this volatile environment that I walked one evening. I opened the front door to find Jenny beating Marley with her fists. She was crying uncontrollably and flailing wildly at him, more like she was pounding a kettle drum than imposing a beating, landing glancing blows on his back and shoulders and neck. "Why? Why do you wreck everything?" In that instant, I saw what he had done. The couch cushion was gouged open, the fabric shredded, and the stuffing pulled out. Marley didn't try to flee or dodge the blows. He just stood there and took each one without whimper or complaint. "Hey! Hey! Hey!" I shouted, grabbing her wrist. "Come on! Stop! Stop!" She was sobbing and gasping for breath. It was like a stranger was staring back at me. I did not recognize the look in her eyes. "Get him out of here," she said, her voice flat and tinged with a quiet burn. "Get him out of here now." I opened the front door and he bounded outside, and when I turned back to grab his leash off the table, Jenny said, "I mean it. I'm done with that dog. You find him a new home, or I will." She couldn't mean it. She loved this dog. She adored him despite his laundry list of shortcomings. She was upset. She was stressed to the breaking point. She would reconsider. For the moment, I thought it was best to give her time to cool down. I walked out the door without another word. In the front yard, Marley raced around, his old jolly self. Out in the street, I hooked him to his leash and ordered, "Sit!" He sat. I pulled the choker chain up high on his throat in preparation for our walk. Before I stepped off, I ran my hand over his head and massaged his neck. He flipped his nose in the air and looked up at me, his tongue hanging halfway down his neck. The incident with Jenny appeared to be behind him. Now I hoped it would be behind her as well. Marley and I walked for miles that evening, and when I finally opened the front door, he was exhausted and ready to collapse quietly in the corner. Jenny was feeding Patrick a jar of baby food as she cradled Connor in her lap. She was calm and appeared back to her old self. I unleashed Marley and he took a huge drink, lapping lustily at the water, sloshing little tidal waves over the side of his bowl. I toweled up the floor and stole a glance in Jenny's direction. She appeared unperturbed. Maybe the horrible moment had passed. Maybe she had reconsidered. As I walked past her, Marley close at my heels, she said in a calm, quiet voice without looking at me, "I'm dead serious. I want him out of here." Over the next several days, she repeated the ultimatum enough times that I finally accepted that this was not an idle threat. She wasn't just blowing off steam, and the issue was not going away. I was sick about it. As pathetic as it sounds, Marley had become my male bonding soulmate, my near-constant companion, my friend. He was the undisciplined, recalcitrant, nonconformist, politically incorrect free spirit I had always wanted to be, had I been brave enough. The thought of giving him up seared my soul. But I had two children to worry about now, and a wife whom we needed. Our household was being held together by the most tenuous of threads. If losing Marley made the difference between meltdown and stability, how could I not honor Jenny's wishes? Each morning I opened the newspaper to the classifieds as if I might find some miracle ad. Seeking, wildly energetic, out-of-control Labrador Retriever, with multiple phobias. Destructive qualities a plus. Will pay top dollar. What I found instead was a booming trade in young adult dogs that, for whatever reason, had not worked out. Many were purebreds that their owners had spent several hundred dollars for just months earlier. An alarming number of the unwanted dogs were male labs. The ads were at once heartbreaking and hilarious, full of sunny euphemisms for the types of behavior I knew all too well. Lively, loves people, needs big yard, needs room to run, energetic, spirited, powerful, one of a kind. When I read fiercely loyal, I knew the seller really meant known to bite. Constant companion meant suffer separation anxiety, and good watchdog translated to incessant barker. And when I saw best offer, I knew too well that the desperate owner really was asking, how much do I need to pay you to take this thing off my hands? Part of me ached with sadness. I was not a quitter. I did not believe Jenny was a quitter either. Marley was nothing like the stately dogs both of us had grown up with. He had a host of bad habits and behaviors. He also had come a great distance from the spastic puppy we had brought home 2 years earlier. In his own flawed way, he was trying. Part of our journey as his owners was to mold him to our needs, but part also was to accept him for what he was. He was a part of our family, and for all his flaws, devotion such as his could not be bought for any price. I was not ready to give up on him. Even as I continued to make half-hearted inquiries about finding Marley a new home, I began working with him in earnest. I began rising at dawn, buckling Patrick into the jogging stroller, and heading down to the water to put Marley through the paces. Sit, stay, down, heel. Over and over we practiced. There was a desperation to my mission, and Marley seemed to sense it. The stakes were different now. This was for real. By the time I re-enrolled Marley in obedience school, he was a different dog from the juvenile delinquent I had first shown up with. Yes, still wild as a boar, but this time he knew I was the boss and he was the underling. This time there would be no lunges toward other dogs, or at least not many. No out-of-control surges across the tarmac, no crashing into strangers' crotches. Through 8 weekly sessions, I marched him through the commands on a tight leash. At our final meeting, the trainer, a relaxed woman who was the antithesis of Miss Dominatrix, called us forward. "Okay," she said, "show us what you got." I ordered Marley into a sit position, and he dropped neatly to his haunches. I raised the choker chain high around his throat, and with a crisp tug of the lead, ordered him to heel. We trotted across the parking lot and back, Marley at my side, his shoulder brushing my calf, just as the book said it should. I ordered him to sit again, and I stood directly in front of him and pointed my finger at his forehead. "Stay," I said calmly, and with the other hand I dropped his leash. I stepped backward several paces. His big brown eyes fixed on me. I walked in a 360-degree circle around him. He quivered with excitement, but he did not budge. When I was back in front of him, just for kicks, I snapped my finger and yelled, "Incoming!" He hit the deck like he was storming Iwo Jima. The teacher burst out laughing, a good sign. I turned my back on him and walked 30 feet away. The volcano was getting ready to blow. Then, spreading my feet into a wide boxer's stance in anticipation of what was coming, I said, "Marley?" I let his name hang in the air for a few seconds. "Come!" He shot at me with everything he had, and I braced for impact. At the last instant, I deftly sidestepped him with a bullfighter's grace, and he blasted past me, then circled back and goosed me from behind with his nose. "Good boy, Marley!" I gushed, dropping to my knees. "Good boy! Good boy!" He danced around me like we had just conquered Mount Everest together. At the end of the evening, the instructor called us up and handed us our diploma. Marley had passed basic obedience training, ranking 7th in his class. So what if it was a class of 8 and the 8th dog was a psychopathic pit bull? I would take it. Marley, my incorrigible, untrainable, undisciplined dog, had passed. I was so proud, I could have cried. There was still one piece of unfinished business between Marley and me. I needed to break him of his worst habit of all, jumping on people. It didn't matter if it was a friend or a stranger, a child or an adult, the meter reader or the UPS driver. Marley greeted them the same way, by charging at them full speed, sliding across the floor, leaping up and planting his 2 front paws on the person's chest or shoulders as he licked their face. What had been cute when he was a cuddly puppy had turned obnoxious, even terrifying for some recipients of his uninvited advances. I had tried without success to break him of jumping up, using standard dog obedience techniques. The message was not getting through. Then a veteran dog owner I respected said, "You want to break him of that? Give him a swift knee in the chest next time he jumps up on you." "I don't want to hurt him," I said. "You won't hurt him. A few good jabs with your knee, and I guarantee you he'll be done jumping." It was tough love time. Marley had to reform or relocate. The next night when I arrived home from work, I stepped in the front door and yelled, "I'm home!" As usual, Marley came barreling across the wood floors to greet me. He slid the last 10 feet as though on ice, then lifted off to smash his paws into my chest and slurp at my face. Just as his paws made contact with me, I gave one swift pump of my knee, connecting in the soft spot just below his ribcage. He gasped slightly and slid down to the floor, looking up at me with a wounded expression, trying to figure out what had gotten into me. He had been jumping on me his whole life. What was with the sudden sneak attack? The next night, I repeated the punishment. He leapt, I kneed. He dropped to the floor, coughing. I felt a little cruel, but if I were going to save him from the classifieds, I knew I had to drive home the point. "Sorry, guy," I said, leaning down so he could lick me with all 4 paws on the ground. "It's for your own good." The third night when I walked in, he came charging around the corner, going into his typical high-speed skid as he approached. This time, however, he altered the routine. Instead of leaping, he kept his paws on the ground and crashed headfirst into my knees, nearly knocking me over. I take that as a victory. "You did it, Marley! You did it! Good boy! You didn't jump up!" And I got on my knees so he could slobber me without risking a sucker punch. I was impressed. Marley had bent to the power of persuasion. The problem was not exactly solved, however. He may have been cured of jumping on me, but he was not cured of jumping on anyone else. The dog was smart enough to figure out that only I posed a threat, and he could still jump on the rest of the human race with impunity. I needed to widen my offensive, and to do that, I recruited a good friend of mine from work, a reporter named Jim Tolpin. Jim was a mild-mannered, bookish sort, balding, bespectacled, and of slight build. If there was anyone Marley thought he could jump up on without consequence, it was Jim. That night, Jim rang the bell and walked in the door. Sure enough, Marley took the bait and raced at him, ears flying back. When Marley left the ground to leap up on him, Jim dealt a withering blow with his knee to Marley's solar plexus, knocking the wind out of him. The thud was audible across the room. Marley let out a loud groan, went bug-eyed, and sprawled on the floor. Marley got to his feet, caught his breath, and greeted Jim the way a dog should, on all four paws. If he could have talked, I swear he would have cried uncle. Marley never again jumped up on anyone, at least not in my presence, and no one ever kneed him in the chest or anywhere else again. One morning, shortly thereafter, I woke up and my wife was back. My Jenny, the woman I loved who had disappeared into that unyielding blue fog, had returned to me. As suddenly as the postpartum depression had swept over her, it swept away again. She was strong, she was upbeat, she was not only coping as a young mother of two, but thriving. Marley was back in her good graces, safely on solid ground. With a baby in each arm, she leaned to kiss him. She threw him sticks and made him gravy from hamburger drippings. She danced him around the room when a good song came on the stereo. Sometimes at night, when he was calm, I would find her lying on the floor with him, her head resting on his neck. Jenny was back. Thank God she was back. Chapter 16. The Audition. Jenny's supervisor at the Palm Beach Post had a friend who needed to ask a favor of us. The friend was a local photographer named Colleen McGarr, who had been hired by a New York City film production company called The Shooting Gallery to help with a movie they planned to make in Lake Worth, the town just south of us. Colleen's job was to find a quintessential South Florida household and photograph it top to bottom, the bookshelves, the refrigerator magnets, the closets, you name it, to help the directors bring realism to the film. The whole set crew is gay, Jenny's boss told her. They're trying to figure out how married couples with kids live around here. Colleen came over and started photographing, not just our possessions, but us too, the way we dressed, the way we wore our hair, the way we slouched on the couch. She photographed toothbrushes on the sink. She photographed the babies in their cribs. She photographed the quintessentially heterosexual couple's eunuch dog, too, or at least what she could catch of him on film. As she observed, he's a bit of a blur. Marley could not have been more thrilled to participate. Ever since babies had invaded, Marley took his affection where he could find it. Colleen, being a lover of large animals and not intimidated by saliva showers, gave him plenty, dropping to her knees to wrestle with him. As Colleen clicked away, I couldn't help thinking of the possibilities. Not only were we supplying raw anthropological data to the filmmakers, we were essentially being given our own personal casting call. I could just picture the director freezing over a single snapshot. In it, a rugged yet sensitive, quintessentially heterosexual male goes about his family man business. The director stubs his finger heavily into the photo and shouts to his assistants, "Get me this man! I must have him for my film!" When they finally track me down, I at first humbly demur, before finally agreeing to take the starring role. Colleen thanked us for opening our home to her and left. Our duty was now fulfilled. But a few days later, when Jenny called me at work to say, "I just got off the phone with Colleen McGarr, and you are not going to believe it," I had no doubt whatsoever that I had just been discovered. My heart leapt. "Go on." "She says the director wants Marley to try out." "Marley?" She didn't seem to notice the dismay in my voice. "Apparently, he's looking for a big, dumb, loopy dog to play the role of the family pet, and Marley caught his eye." "Loopy?" I asked. "Big, dumb, and loopy." Well, he had certainly come to the right place. Did Colleen mention if he said anything about me?" I asked. "No," Jenny said. "Why would he?" Colleen picked Marley up the next day. Knowing the importance of a good entrance, he came racing through the living room to greet her at full bore, pausing only long enough to grab the nearest pillow in his teeth, because you never knew when a busy film director might need a quick nap, and if he did, Marley wanted to be ready. 2 hours later, Colleen and company were back, and the verdict was in. Marley had passed the audition. "Oh, shut up!" Jenny shrieked. "No way!" Our elation was not dampened a bit when Colleen told us Marley was the only one up for the part, nor when she broke the news that his would be the only non-paying role in the movie. The movie was called The Last Home Run, a baseball fantasy in which a 79-year-old nursing home resident becomes a 12-year-old for 5 days to live his dream of playing Little League ball. Marley was cast as the hyperactive family dog of the Little League coach, played by retired Major League catcher Gary Carter. As the first day of filming approached, Jenny became stage mom extraordinaire. She bathed him.